Now, most of us spend most of our time in evangelism up here. We spend about 90% of our time as Christians in evangelism in what, I'll give these numbers so I can refer to them more easily. Each of these we will call a level. Level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, level 5, and level 6. Most of us are level 5 and level 6 people. Now, that is the deadliest curse today in evangelism. We are not spending our time where most of the people are. Now, most of the young people, or adults, or any other segment of the population that you find, are going to be somewhere either underneath or at level 1 of this triangle. That is, they will either have no awareness of the gospel, or they will just barely be aware of what the gospel of Jesus Christ really is. And we ought to spend most of our interest, time, energy, and activity doing something about this mass group of individuals all around us that we never touch because we never think of being responsible for them. We're all always ready to get the hook in the mouth of the fish, but we never worry about putting water in the lake and creating an environment in which fish can swim and come to the hook. And I don't know of anything that is a greater burden or concern to me than the matter of making non-Christians aware of the gospel of Jesus Christ. We had a 32-year-old divorcee who, like the woman that Jesus talked to in Samaria, had been married several times and was now living with a man she had not bothered to marry. And she came to my office. And she said, I am looking for personal peace. I am searching for personal peace. And I took a blank sheet of paper and I said, all right, let's find out what is already inside you that we can begin to draw on to find the answers you're looking for. So I asked her, I just wrote down words, and I said, now tell me the things that are important in your life about these words. And the first one was God. Well, she had some fuzzy ideas about God. The Bible, she had practically no significant knowledge of the Bible. We talked about some other things that were principles, and then on the other side of the place, I listed values, things in her value system, morality, and other things that would be in the category of value systems. And finally, at the bottom of the page, I wrote, now, tell me everything you know about this word and the person who is named Jesus. And I wrote the word Jesus, and there was a long dead silence, and she said, I don't know anything about him. Now, that didn't happen in Singapore. That happened in the United States of America. And I think that we are so blind in our own activity as Christian workers. I have a picture that I cut out of Psychology Magazine that I have been using with groups in Singapore. And it shows two rows of people, and each person has a false face that is the exact duplicate of his own face. And he has taken off this false face, and he has turned it around, and he has shoved it in front of the face that he's talking to. So you have these pairs of people, everybody talking to the other one, but putting their mask on the face of the other person. So there are about four sets of these people, and the impact of it is just fantastic, because this is what we do most of the time. We go to a non-Christian, we take off our past experiences and shove it in front of their face and talk to them like we know all about them. When the fact is that for the highest percentage of people in the high school or the junior high school where you are working today, there are scores and scores and scores of kids that are simply unaware of what the gospel of Jesus Christ is. And if you're going to set up an effective evangelism ministry, the first and most important thing is not how do you train kids to be soul winners. The most important thing is how do you communicate to those who have absolutely no knowledge of the gospel of Jesus Christ whatsoever. How do you let them know, how do you make them aware that there are those who have the sweet fragrance of Jesus Christ within them, and that these are people that have found a better lifestyle than they have found. And we just don't even have a clue as to what to do here. When I went to Singapore to try to develop a principle of evangelism that could penetrate 2.25 million Buddhist, Taoist, pagan Chinese people, we had to really work hard at level one awareness. Now, that awareness will usually come at a subconscious or a semi-conscious level. And so we have to take a person to the next level, which is willingness to receive. Is this person willing to receive any knowledge of what he now has an awareness of? How can we communicate with him? Now, this willingness to receive does not mean that the person is ready to make a decision. It simply means for the first time they are open to knowledge which may lead them to evaluate their value system, which may lead them to make a commitment. So another group that we virtually ignore and ought to spend an awful lot of time working with are those who are now unwilling to receive. They're aware, but they're not willing to receive. And almost always, their problem is the problem of distortions in their past, which make it impossible for them now emotionally to accept anything more about Christianity. How many times have you heard, "My mother shoved this down my throat, and I want no more part of it. Get away from me." Now that's a distortion, and that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. All Christians are hypocrites. Yeah, I knew, my next door neighbor, you know, he used to go to church all the time, and he'd swear like a sailor at his kid. And we have all of these distortions that are just allowed to rest year in and year out in the minds of people, and it makes them unwilling to receive. So we've got to, first of all, be concerned about those who are unaware to make them aware. And that is a form of evangelism. And then we must take those who are aware and assist them so that they will be willing to receive. And that is another form of evangelism. And then when a person is willing to receive, we come to the matter of just planting knowledge inside them. Now that knowledge does not lead to decisions for Christ. I think the greatest mistake that Campus Crusade has made has been the idea that if you take the four spiritual laws and give people this little piece of knowledge, that they will ipso facto become a Christian. All they're waiting for are the four laws. And I have heard all of the testimonies for years about the guy that sits down beside somebody on an airplane and the man says, "Hey, have you heard of the four spiritual laws?" And 10 minutes later, the tears are in his eyes and he's just praying to receive Christ, and it's all so simple. Now that's just a bunch of baloney. When you meet a person like that, you have met a person who is at the point of making a commitment. And if he is at that point and you give him the four spiritual laws, I know of nothing that can be more significant or effective in helping him come to Jesus Christ. But, oh, if I don't pound anything home in this session this morning, I want to ram this home as hard as I can. People do not come to Jesus Christ on the basis of knowledge. The matter of receiving Jesus Christ is not a knowledge decision. It is a value system decision. Now, we just got to understand that, people. And if we will, our whole concept of evangelism is going to change. A value system is knowledge which has developed into more than brain understanding. It has developed into an attitude. It has developed into a way of taking that knowledge and making it a piece of me. It has then become subconscious, and I now do it automatically. My value system as a non-Christian is being challenged, not my knowledge system. There was a day when I could not tie a shoelace. There was a day when a young medical doctor in my father's church in Elyria, Ohio, when I was about 5 years old, was sitting in our living room, and I said, "Dr. Ben, tie my shoe." He said, "Son, you're 5. Can't you tie your shoe yet?" I said, "No." He said, "I'm going to teach you to tie your shoe." I hated that man. For the next 30 minutes, he made my life miserable. All I wanted was my shoe tied so I could play. And we tied it and untied it, and untied it and tied it. And we went it over it and over it and over it. I was at a knowledge level. I was getting information. The next morning, I got up and I said, "Mama, tie my shoe." And she said, no, son, now you can tie your own shoes. It was with a great deal of work that I tied the shoes. I've been tying shoes ever since. It's now a part of my lifestyle. I never think about it. I just tie the knot and go on. I never even give it a thought. Now, a person has a value system, and that value system was developed through that procedure in many areas. The area of morals, the area of social relationships, the area of goals, the area of what I consider to be important, the area of ego development. All of these things are within me, and you come along and you say to me, accept Jesus. What are you doing? You are literally asking me to transform my entire value system. And that isn't done with a four spiritual laws. And so we must recognize that when an individual is willing to receive, he may have a brief attention span, and it's enough to drop in to that little vacuum in his life, enough to fill the vacuum, but don't give him too much. Because like a glass of water, once the glass is full to the top, the rest of it's going to spill over and drip all over the ground. And so it's important to recognize that if a person says, hey, why don't you drink? That maybe the glass has just enough room in it for you to give them about a 30-second answer, and it better be the right one, and let it go at that. Because controlled attention are simply bits of information that are to come into the life of that individual. And when that has happened, then there is something inside that value system, in the memory bank of the mind, and you can draw from it to help that person along towards the eventual making of a decision. So a controlled attention may have a span of 1 second, it may have a span of 1 minute, or you may, as that person develops, have a span of 1 hour for a particular kind of evangelistic Bible study. Then the matter of relationships. Now, I recognize that in your reach out material that you are using the word touch. And I also recognize that I coined that word in the first place. And I am thrilled and delighted that the reach out material used the word touch. But I want to expand your understanding of what I meant, which is not fully communicated in reach out material, when I began to use the word touch. Whenever you think of the word touch, remember that touch takes time. And just sashaying over to the campus for a few minutes every afternoon and making contact with kids is a total violation of what you ought to think of touch as being. Because those little spot contacts with people are not going to be anything but spot contacts with people. And once you make the initial touch, in order for you to have an effective evangelistic ministry with that young person, you are going to have to spend hours with that young person. And there is no easy way to avoid that. Money can't do this. Material printed cannot do this. It's going to take a human life touching a human life. And time is an important factor. And I'll explain the reason. When I was just a little kid, I had a friend named Rennie. He was a British boy. He lived in New Jersey, about four houses down the street from me. Rennie and I played together in the snow. And one day he said, my mama has invited you to have dinner at our house. I said, all right. I went and asked my mama, and she said it was okay, so I went to Rennie's house for dinner. I sat down in this very wicked home. And when it came time to eat, there was not a single glass of water on the table. Now, ever since I've been taken off a bottle, I've been drinking water with my meal. There was no water with the meal, no. I nearly choked. The mashed potatoes became drier, the meat became tougher, there wasn't any water anywhere. And I was just a dumb little kid, and here was this big imposing Britishman at the head of this family table, and I wasn't about to ask for any water. And finally we got all the way through the meal, finished the dessert, and she brought out a small glass of water for each of us. I nearly choked trying to get it down. And I went home and I said to my mother, Mama, we didn't have any water at the table. And my mother said, what? She was Pennsylvania Dutch. You didn't have water with your meal? No, Mama. Why didn't they have water with their meal? My mother said, I don't have the slightest idea. I never heard of people eating meals without water. I went to my father. Daddy, why don't they have water when they drink their meal? I don't know. I never heard of a thing like that. So I went to Rennie the next day in the snow, and I said, Rennie, why don't you drink water when you eat your dinner at night? And he said, who ever heard of drinking water with your meal? I said, well, we do all the time. You do? Why, I never heard anything like that. Well, why don't you have water with your meal? I don't know. Let's go ask my mama. So we got up to the house and shook the snow off our little snowshoes and went into the entryway of the house. And he said, Mama, will you tell Ralphie why we don't have water with our meals? And the mother said, why, son? It's because if you ate water with your meals, your food won't digest properly. Oh. Now, here were two value systems in my young life that were coming into conflict with each other. Now, I had to make a decision on the basis of the value system. Value systems are where evangelism is powerful. And when you eliminate that long-term relationship with a group of individuals, when your touch does not take time, there is no possibility that your value system will be so evident they will be challenged to think it through. It is at the point of relationship that I see my value system in full perspective as I compare it with your value decision, and then I come to a point where I have to make a choice. In that particular case, I can remember wading on through the snow on my way home, thinking to myself, my great-grandmother is 80 years old, she drinks water with her meal. My father drinks water with his meals. My mother drinks water with her meals. My mama and my papa are as old as the Sphinx, and they drink water with their meals. It sure hasn't killed them to their value system. And from that day to this, I had water with my meals. Now, it was a decision I had to make based on relationship. And I would suggest that the most important part of evangelism is pre-evangelism. And the most important part of pre-evangelism is time. And if you're not going to take a lot of time with somebody, don't bother to take any time with them, because you're just wasting your time hitting a lot of little people for a little few minutes and never staying with anybody long enough to really make an impact on them. And the biggest problem in church work today is the fact that church workers will not discipline themselves to settle down with a few people and develop them and disciple them, or if they're not Christians, win them to Jesus Christ, and not leave them until they put enough time in for it to make a difference. And that's where we're suffering the most in evangelism. Now, when it comes time to make a decision, all of these factors must be present. The person must be aware. They must be willing to receive. And there must be those periods of controlled attention which have given them enough intellectual content for them to understand what it means to fall in love with the person of Jesus Christ. There must have been enough relationship with Christ specifically that one can fall in love with him. I wrote my son a letter from Indonesia. When I had made a trip over there before we were signed to Southeast Asia, I had met Dr. Wynne Applewhite's teenage daughter, the most beautiful woman I've ever seen apart from my wife. And I said to myself, she's not only physically gorgeous, she's one of the most deeply spiritual girls I've ever met in my whole born days. She is the perfect daughter-in-law for Ralph W. Hayman. I wrote my son Ralph, and I gave him a long list of all the reasons why he ought to marry Dr. Wynne Applewhite's daughter. And I said, now, son, here's her address. And she is really looking forward to corresponding with you. And I'm sending her picture in the next letter. I got a Polaroid. I took her picture there at the seminary in Indonesia, at Semarang. I sent it to Ralph. I got home from that trip. I got off the airplane. We had hardly gotten in the car to drive back to our apartment in Houston before I said, Ralph, have you written to Wynne Applewhite's daughter yet? He gave me one of those 20-year-old looks that said, you old buzzard, you keep your nose out of my love life. A China boy I ain't, and a China man you ain't, and a matchmaker for me, Father, you will never be. And I learned something. I learned that falling in love is a deeply personal activity. And you want to know one of the reasons why we've got about half of the members of Baptist churches across the United States who have been baptized and catechized and hypnotized and mesmerized and homogenized and training unionized and all of the other isms that we can give to them, and they're on their way straight to hell with their name on a church roll? It's because we have forgotten that becoming a Christian is a matter of falling in love with Jesus Christ. Friend, there was a morning when I sat on the edge of a bed in a men's dormitory at Wheaton College, and I was putting on my left brown sock. And as I pulled it on, I said to myself, "Neighbor, you have been dating that soccer sleek and flicker for 3.5 months now, and neighbor, you just better face it. You can't live without it." And that was the day I decided to propose to my Ruthie. And nobody had to force me into it, and I didn't need a 4-page booklet to show me how to do it. Becoming a Christian. What is it? Becoming a Christian is falling in love with Jesus Christ and saying to yourself, "I don't care how badly it tears up my old value system. I can't live without him a minute more." And that's what evangelism is all about. All right, now, let me give you 17 things as fast as I can read them to go with this that we're not going to get a chance to cover. And then we'll go to the question and answer time. Principle one, there is no such thing as mass evangelism. There is only personal evangelism. People are only one to Christ, one by one. Principle number two, an evangelism ministry will never be greater than the number of evangelists. Principle number three, evangelists are, by definition, 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 14 through 16, nothing more or less than fragrant people. He everywhere uses us to reveal and spread abroad the fragrance of the knowledge of himself. We are indeed the incense offered by Christ to God, both for those who are on the way to salvation and for those who are on the way to perdition. To the latter, it is a deadly fume that kills. To the former, a vital fragrance that brings life. The most important thing, therefore, that you have to share is not knowledge, but the fragrance, the one who dwells within you. Principle number four, a ratio of 3 outsiders to 1 Christian is just about the right number when you're trying to be an evangelist. God so loved the world, but you can't love 3 billion, 4 billion, 4.2 billion people. You can't even love 100 people. You're stretching it if you can write down the names of 15 people on a piece of paper that you love deeply enough that you'd be willing to die for them. And evangelism is most effective when it's 3 to 1. And when you are giving time to 3 people at a time who really love, who really need to know the Christ you love. Principle number 5. Only 10% of any church at any given time in the history of that church can be led to be evangelists. Now you just think about that one. A church membership is all strung out in the spiritual pilgrimage. From the divorcee who's so emotionally crippled that she can't be expected to do a thing for anyone else. But gradually, at any given time, there are people who are floating up to the top like cream in a milk pail. They're floating up to the top and they're getting rich enough that the fragrance is there. So don't try to have a mass evangelism training in the church. All you do is frustrate a bunch of people by giving them an oughtness when it ought to be an overflow and say, "Boy, if you're a Christian, you ought to be an evangelist." Because it doesn't work. Roughly 10%. Find that 10%. Principle 6, people do not become Christians through knowledge, but through value systems being shared. Principle number 7, to develop evangelists, you become the model of what you are telling them they ought to be doing. Principle number 8, don't force all Christians into a single mold of evangelism. Evangelism is simply being a fragrant person. And that kind of fragrance can be nonverbal as well as verbal. I avoid like the plague in my church all programs like a wind program in which everybody has got to do it the same way. God didn't make us with the same set of faces, the same color hair, the same color eyes. And there are multitudes of ways that people can share Jesus. And when you tell them that this is the way, and if you don't do it this way, you're a dirty bird, you just break the hearts of Christians who never reach their full potential on the basis of their own spiritual gifts. Principle number 9, fragrant people are like plants. There are all types. A rose has an odor. So does a clove, but a clove doesn't look like a rose. And a mint leaf doesn't look like either a rose or a clove, but it also has its own special odor. So treat people personally when you're trying to develop an evangelism ministry. Principle number 10, Christians evangelize through their gifts. They evangelize through what God has empowered them to be and to do. The gift of serving, the gift of giving, the gift of helping others in distress, the gift of faith, the gift of teaching, the gift of the paraclete or the counselor. There are many spiritual gifts, and every time one recognizes the significance of what God has caused them to be, we should recognize the significance of the way, of the manner in which His fragrance will be known to the non-Christian. Principle number 11. Christians can pre-evangelize using their talents. And here's what I mean by that. If I have a talent of playing guitar, I can make contact with non-Christians by starting a guitar class. If I know how to repair motorcycles, that's a touch point. And I can start a touch group helping non-Christians learn how to fix motorcycles. If I can cook, I can have a cooking touch group. I had a woman in our church who was a state champion baton twirler. She got junior high girls, invited them to come into her backyard and twirl the baton. Gradually, she developed a relationship with them, and they would spread out on her den rug, and she'd pass around Cokes and Good News for Modern Man, and the baton twirling class became a Bible study group. She had used her talents, something we virtually ignore, as a way of having the long-term kind of touch relationship. Principle number 12, roots come before fruits. Pre-evangelism is crucial, and we've got to spend a lot more time at levels 1 and 2 than we're now spending. Principle number 13, scratch where people itch. Many times people are turned off by a kind of evangelism that does not come to where their needs happen to be. And that means you've got to shut up and listen before you open your mouth and talk. So you can discover like a doctor what the sickness is before you come up with the right prescriptions. Principle number 14, answer what is being asked. Answer what is being asked. I, from time to time, throughout my lifetime of ministry, go back and order a Coke and sit in a bar for a couple of hours and just listen to the conversation going on around me, because I'm sure not going to find out what sinners are talking about sitting in that stupid office in the church building. I need to be able to know what they're talking about so I can talk to them effectively. Principle number 15. Time is the key ingredient in winning people to Christ. Principle number 16, deal with distortions. Don't attack them, deal with them. My mother rammed religion down my throat. I've had all of it I want, and I'm fed up with it. That is a distortion. You don't get defensive about mama. You sneak up on the blind side, but until that distortion is out of the way, that person is blind to the gospel. Principle number 17, people will not cross natural barriers to come to Jesus Christ. That's the last one. They will not cross natural barriers to come to Jesus Christ. A girl, a boy, has a certain cultural, social life, and they live in that life. And if you pull them out of that life and put them into another kind of structure in order to get the gospel, you're going to lose them every time. We get the church program set up and we think we got a red-hot, gung-ho, super-duper teenage youth program, and boy, we think it's so great, and then we try to go and we try to get the kid who's in a motorcycle gang to come in. We try to get the kid who's living in the jock world to come in, and it just doesn't fit. And we are not aware of the fact that we're losing a lot of kids just because we've got one kind of youth program, and it is not the one that may fit their lifestyle, and they're having to cross a natural barrier of their lifestyle to get into the what we set up to be the program through which Jesus Christ is prepared. And that's why touch ministries have to be extremely versatile and very mobile, and why they seldom ever are going to begin meeting in a church building. But they may be in a gasoline station where guys come in at Thursday night after the gas station is closed and bring their motorcycles in, and they're laying around on the ground fixing an engine or doing this or that, and there's a guy who's got grease up to his elbows with him who is helping them to know Jesus Christ in that gas station. He could never win them in the Sunday school annex of the local church. He's going to have to win them where they are. People will not cross natural barriers in order to receive the gospel. Well, that's the hay rack unloaded for this morning. Now, you want to talk?
How about defining, again, for me, the value system, and give a little insight as far as what that consists of?
A person's value system is the sum total of all their yesterdays. And a value system is always picked up like the measles. You just catch it around. Value systems are social diseases. They're just picked up from here and there. And a kid's value system is picked up from his mother and his father and his grandparents and the neighborhood he lives in and the crises he's had in his life and the ways that he has found to be protective of himself because he's been screamed and hollered at by his parents. Or he's learned to be open because his parents have been very gentle and loving people. And he's got this set of values right now. And those values are going to have to do with his own self-image, his own attitude toward himself, his attitude toward his body, toward his mind, his attitude of relating to the peer group that he runs with. Am I accepted by a peer group? And what peer group can I break into?
In this area, Cook and Monroe, or is it your only purpose of the pastor in order that you may share Christ with them? Now, what's the motivation point behind that?
Now, I'm trying to figure out what your motivation is in answering the question. Are you afraid of it?
Of what?
Of the group?
No. I see value in the group, and what I'm kind of struggling with is to understand groups like this. Do we do it so we can witness to them, so we can share Christ with them? Or isn't there value in just
now I got
helping
it.
Them to become more okay. individuals in that certain area?
What literally, according exactly to the Greek, does Matthew 28:19 say? The first phrase is, as what? As what? As, say it.
As you go.
Say it together.
As you go,
do what? Make disciples. Now that's the principle of a touch group. What am I doing? I'm in a cooking group here. Am I going to give them a quality experience in cooking? Shame on me if I don't. Is my only purpose in being in that cooking class in order that I can win them to Christ? You bet it is. And no, that's not the purpose at all. And you've got to keep those two things in tension. Yes, that's why I'm here. No, that's not why I'm here. And you're caught in the tension between them. Like Tommy Alford says, it's like two rails on a railroad track. They got to stay that way. Because if they ever get together, the train can't run. But there is a sense in which I, as a Christian, whether I'm buying an automobile or whether I am visiting with my next door neighbor, or whatever it is, I'm doing it in the name of Jesus Christ. And there is also another part of me that says, whether I win that guy to Christ or not, I got to buy a car. Whether I can really win this waitress to the Lord or not, I got to eat my meal. And I'm caught in the tension between that. And the best way I can describe this is to say, when I get into a group for lonely people, personality development, how to fall in love successfully, or any of the other touch ministries that we have developed in the past, divorce aid care groups or whatever it is, there is a total person. And I need to see that person as complete. And I need to recognize that if that person is interested in cooking, that is not an evil satanic interest. And we can enjoy doing that. And my life system, my value system, is going to be reflected in ways that I can never even anticipate in advance into that person's life. But I never release people to develop their own touch ministry until I've given them about 32 hours of training. We're going through a class right now that we'll finish in December for about 50 at our church, and then we'll be releasing them to develop touch ministries. Because in addition to those 10 weeks that they spend together in a touch group, there are to be two visits one-on-one with each of the three people that this Christian in the group will be working with. There are eight in a touch group. There are two Christians, and there are three non-Christians that are the particular prayer burden of each of these Christians. And so you have eight in the group, and they meet together in the group for the 10 weeks, and they're cooking or photographing or whatever they're doing, but there are these two separate contacts that are made with each one of these by that Christian. And in that separate contact, the visits are in visit. There's an in visit and an out visit. The first visit, you go into the world of that non-Christian. Meet all the friends, meet mother and dad, meet brother and sister. Where do you go? Where do you play? Where do you eat? What do you do? I'm going to go. I'm going to do it with you. I'm going to be a part of your world. The second visit is bringing them out of their world into my world, into my value system world. Come to church with me. Come to a teenage youth party with me that is being held in a home. And it's really something the church is sponsoring. But no problem here. The relationship is there. The friendship is there. And they come on over. Now, in this first visit, no later than this in visit, I give my testimony. I want to tell you the greatest thing that has ever happened in my life. And in 1 minute, I let that person know what Jesus has done in my life so that my value system clearly stands out as being what it is because Jesus Christ has come to live within me. Now, we just finished this whole thing in Singapore, and I tell you, it was so exciting. 10 weeks with pagans, Buddhists, Taoists, that had absolutely no knowledge of God, Jesus, the Bible, or anything about Christianity. And in that first 10-week period, the relationships developed. We never lost a single person from a touch group when we went into the second 10-week cycle of a Bible study, which we did not call a Bible study. But in that Bible study, we did two things. We answered the 10 major objections that we discovered by taking a survey of 1,500 pagans that never had gone to church in their life. We said, what is your greatest objection to Christianity? We took the 10 greatest objections, we answered one a week, and the rest of the time we learned about Jesus. And we got the knowledge of who Jesus was so people could fall in love with him. And we never lost a single person, not one person in the 2 years that we worked in this, because the relationships were so solidly cemented by the end of the touch ministries that they went right on in. And there was no pressure. They just fell in love with Jesus. And at the end of that 20-week cycle, you say, that's a long time to win a person to Christ. Oh, is it really? That's not long at all. When you realize that when you have met that one person, then you can disciple the group he represents to the fringes. There's a mother, there's a father, there's a brother, there's a sister. There are a whole group of people now that can be related to Jesus Christ because you've penetrated with that one person. So you spend your time going this way. And that is a key issue. But it's a matter of saying, yeah, whether you accept the Lord or not, you know, I love you and I'm your friend. And we're not going to get to the point where I finally say, well, you take my hand and accept Jesus, and if you don't, then that's the end of you. I'm only interested in getting people saved. You know, you go right on loving because God has a timetable in that life. And it may be what you invest now will be harvested a couple or 3 years or 10 years later. So that's the way it's got to go. Yeah.
How does this model of evangelism affect your preaching and your education ministry in the church?
Well, it has affected my preaching and my educational ministry in my church in every possible way. I see myself as a pastor, as the equipper of my people. And if I model for them the all-star evangelist in the pulpit every Sunday morning, then there is nothing that they can copy because they are not preachers, they haven't been to seminary, they can't get up and preach a red-hot three-point sermon with a deathbed illustration, and so I very seldom preach an evangelistic sermon. I have yet to preach an evangelistic sermon in my pulpit since I came back from Singapore. And my concern and my burden is, how can I not be the hired holy man, but the player coach? I'm playing with them. They're watching me as I model on the level of what a layman can do, not what a preacher can do. But I, on their level, what can I do that can show them how one is led to Christ? And in my preaching, what do they need? What do they need from the pulpit so that they are equipped to minister themselves? That's the emphasis of my preaching. What can I do to equip them? They must increase, I must decrease, has been the motto of my heart as a pastor. And then, in the matter of teaching, oh, I discovered this early in the history of West Memorial. You get an old boy, maybe he's been a deacon for 15 years, and that means passing the plate and passing the communion. And you get that old boy sitting in a living room, and he and another old boy that has also been a Baptist all his life, and he doesn't know beans from apple butter either about what it means to defend the gospel. You get those two characters sitting together in a living room, and you got six non-Christians outnumbering them, and no pulpit to hide behind, and the guy begins to say, why does God send people to hell who have never heard about Jesus Christ? You Christians say that Jesus is the only way. Well, what about all the people who lived before Jesus in the history of the world? Did God send them all to hell? Now, you know what he's going to do? He's going to come running with fire in his eyes, and he's going to say, Pastor, I am not going to let go of your britches until you answer that question for me. And our educational system for adults has been structured on the fact that we educate for people who are going to hit problems, and we try to help them solve those problems when they hit them. An adult Bible study training course that goes on year after year, whether it meets in one auditorium with one preacher, or whether it meets in groups of eight using Sunday school literature from Nashville, or any other way, an adult Bible training course that cannot produce the fruit of people who can communicate their faith, in my book, is just next to worthless. Bible study that does not produce evangels is ineffective Bible study. And it ought to have a purpose to it. And when you begin this kind of a concept of ministering, people are motivated in a way that they never would be otherwise. And we sell an awful lot of books from our book table, and our book table is open every time the doors are open, Sunday morning, Sunday night. We sell books, and we try to handpick the kind of books that will equip our people. We had a young pastor from our church who went out who's just lost his church because he begged them to start a book table. He'd seen what it meant to us. And they had one of those meetings where the people in the wheelchairs were called in, you know, who hadn't been to church in 20 years. They voted down the book table. And so he's crushed and broken and called me, and he's looking for a church. They just ran him off because he just went in the book table. Mm-hmm. Now, another day, I'd like to talk to you about how to take people through change without being blown out of the saddle. And I think tomorrow, if the leadership here would let me, I'd rather do that, because I've got three whole sessions on discipleship already, and I don't have that much in the hay rack to give another one tomorrow. But I really could say some things about how to go through change
without getting blown out of the saddle. Would it be all right if I switch and do that? Okay? Right?
You're speaking from a pastor's standpoint now. For us who are staffers, and maybe possibly in a situation where the pastor cannot understand these principles, how do we apply these in our own ministry under his ministry without threatening him?
Very slowly. I tell you, friend, I have great sympathy for a church staffer. We're going to have a whole session on that. And I think rather than get into it with 2 minutes left, I'll wait. And we're going to spend a whole hour on that together.
And if I understood your statement, that 10% of any church in the history of that church will be evangelists.
I am telling you that today or next year or the year after, whether they've got 100, 1,000, or 10,000 members, the rule of thumb, and sometimes it's violated in an occasional church, but very seldom, about 1 out of 10 are going to be spiritually capable, ready, motivated, and committed to reach out.
Even when you have, as you were saying, your Sunday school and everything leading up to train them as evangelists.
Well, does your Sunday school and your training union train evangelists?
That's one of the aims.
But is it producing them?
Some. When we put our lives into them individually.
What percent? Oh, when you put your lives into them individually.
That's the key to it.
The key is. I do not know. And I have been asking this question for years and years and years and years, moving around in denominational work and every way I can. I do not know of many churches, if any, that have... Right now, we've got just about 10% of the people in our church that are taking Touch Basic training. Now, we've got some others who have had it and are moving on out. We've had some who have taken it and aren't doing anything with it because they've been pastorless for a while. But I don't know. I've talked to Jim Kennedy about this. His evangelism explosion thing has been built on the basis of 10% of his members.
How do you deal with distortion?
Well, the first thing you need to do is to fully understand the distortion. You've got to talk about it long enough to really understand all that is involved. My mother rammed church down my throat. Okay, start with the first two words, my mother. What is the general attitude toward that mother? Did she do anything besides ram church down my throat to give me this tremendous hostility toward her? Well, probably so. She was an angry woman in many ways. She over-controlled my life in lots of ways. So dealing with the last half of the statement may not be the way to deal with the distortion at all. But it may be that what needs to be done is for this person to get a little more mature awareness of what my mother is. And when I can help that person look beyond mother's faults to see mother's needs, then I have defanged those teeth that want to tear. And as I sensitize this person to who mother really was that caused her to act this way, and I let some of that pressure out, then we can come back and say, you know what? Maybe you threw the baby out with the bathwater. Maybe you got so mad at mother that you transferred all that anger to something that is really not what you ought to be angry at. Why don't we take a look at it? There isn't any cut and dried answer to what you're asking, of course, but I think the key principle is do enough listening to really get the broad perspective and then work at the root of the problem. Yes?
Level one, awareness. What would you see as being the primary way in which you make someone aware of the gospel in an early point of relationship without overdoing it, so to speak, because what you're talking about, the book, talking so forth?
Let them know that there's a well where they can drink. That's a level one activity. Don't ram the water down their throat. Don't insist that they take the cup. Let them know there's a well where they can drink. I don't know of a more effective way to do that than with a logo. You know what a logo is? A logo is a sign that nobody recognizes and has previous distortions about because they've never seen it before. I never use a cross as a logo. It means too many things to too many people. But a logo is something that has no meaning until you give it meaning, and you display that logo simultaneously with providing unique ministries in the name of that logo that say, we are people who care, we are the people of God, we are the family of God, we are around you. And you penetrate first with the logo, with a physical symbol. Now that girl I mentioned to you walked into our church building because we had a building and she drove by it every day on her way to work. But there were many years when my church did not have a building of any sort, and we had just as many people coming to us. Topless strippers and lesbians and alcoholics and all kinds of people who were coming to an apartment house where we rented one apartment with a couple of bedrooms converted into offices. They came in there. Why? Because all over the neighborhood, on the cash registers and beer joints and in restaurants and in gasoline stations, with little green stickers with the logo that said, the people who care can be reached any time of the day or night at 497-2420. If I were a youth worker and I wanted to penetrate like this, I'd get t-shirts for my kids. I'd get book jackets that could go on books. I'd get pins they can wear. I'd get all kinds of things that are typically teenager, but I would not release it until I had trained the people wearing it to be the people who care. If they don't go together, you're dead. It's time to quit. Thank you.